Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host from New York, Ankit Panda, and joining me today are my colleagues here at the Diplomat, Shannon Tiazzi and Prashant Parameshwaran. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast again, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure.
Great. And on this week's podcast, we're just going to break our time up and discuss some of the recent events in Asian politics in general. We'll begin by talking about Japan's response to the Islamic State's murders of two of its citizens, an event that is being compared to 9/11 in Japan particularly and is being read as a major turning point for Japan's security policy. Already, Japan is considering constitutional overhaul under its new government, which is led by Shinzo Abe, a right-wing conservative, and him and his allies have expressed an interest in revamping Japan's constitution for a long time. So we'll talk about that, following which we'll talk about the Russia-India-China trilateral talks that took place in Beijing this past week, shortly after U.S. President Barack Obama left India. And finally, we'll end up talking about U.S.-Thailand relations and the Cobra Gold exercise, which Prashant will help us understand a bit more since he's our Southeast Asia-focused editor. All right, let's talk a bit about the tragic resolution to the Islamic State's hostage crisis involving two Japanese hostages. So sadly and predictably, they were ultimately killed at the hands of the Islamic State after the Abe government said that, and I quote, they would do whatever they can to rescue these Japanese citizens abroad. And the use of that phrase I thought was pretty interesting because, it essentially, when you have a nationalist leader who's interested in revamping the Constitution saying that, well, I'm going to do everything I can, but under the Constitution, there's literally, there's very little I can do apart from negotiating financially with the hostages. Obviously, the situation evolved from a hostage situation for ransom for a prisoner swap with a Jordanian-held terrorist, ultimately. But again, none of this worked out in the Islamic State, ended up murdering these Japanese citizens. What is your read on this situation? I mean, do you think that this will have a major impact on the debate in Japan to revamp the constitution? Obviously, there are many pacifist voices also that came out after this that said they should affirm Japan's principles and commitment to the pacifist constitution. But equally, it has also emboldened conservatives who'd like to see Article 9 done away with and Japan truly become a modern, normal military power.
I think this is definitely a case of both sides taking this event and seeing in it what they're already inclined to see. As you mentioned, the people who are against revising Japan's constitution, against Japan expanding its military security presence overseas, look at this and say, you know, these two hostages, their lives were first threatened after Shinzo Abe went on a trip to the Middle East and pledged $200 million in non-military aid to join the fight against Islamic State. So this is a direct result of Japan becoming more involved in the Middle East, our citizens being put at risk. So more involvement is not the answer. Less involvement is what we need. And then on the other side of that, you have Shinzo Abe and people who agree with him that Japan should have a more expanded security presence saying, these events are going to happen regardless of what Japan does, and we need to put ourselves in a better position to respond to them and to take care of our citizens and our interests abroad. So it's definitely going to color the debate, but at this point, it seems to have given both sides more or less equal ammunition. I don't think it's really going to tip the balance one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. I think 2015, if anything, is going to be a major year now in Japan, I think, for this debate about constitutional reform. After Abe won the snap election, there was a lot of short-term concern that we could see constitutional amendments coming in simply because the LDP and their coalition partners, the New Kumeito, were actually not in favor of constitutional amendments, seemed to look more powerful than ever in Japanese politics. And it looks like they're going to be around for a while. But fortunately, there are a lot of legislative obstacles that the LDP will have to overcome. Most notably, there is Article 96 of the Japanese Constitution, which sets a very high bar for amendments, notably that two-thirds majorities are required in each house of the Japanese Diet, and an affirmative vote of at a special referendum. So obviously, acquiring that won't be easy for the LDP, barring a major change in the public debate in Japan. I haven't seen any polling been done on how maybe people that were pacifists before this crisis have either changed their opinions or grown less hostile to the prospect of Japan becoming a normal power. That would be interesting to see. I don't know, Prashant, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with both of you. I think, you know, the broad scope of the debate on both sides, you know, they will take from it, from the crisis, what they want and sort of play to their own arguments.
Mm-hmm.
I think what will be interesting to see is kind of some of the domestic things that have come out of this. So I think the chief cabinet secretary of Japan was mentioning that this might be a reason for Japan to strengthen some of their security measures at home in terms of securing airports, train stations, and things like that. And there's also mention about, you know, this is something for Japan to think about when it's hosting the 2020 Olympics, which are going to be held in Tokyo. So that's a little bit something that's further out, but it's also interesting to think about how it's going to affect Japan domestically as opposed to just the foreign policy element, which I think is, you know, a big debate that's going on.
And before we get ahead of ourselves and start talking generally about, you know, changing the constitution, it's important to remember that Abe has his first test already set. He has to pass security legislation affirming last year's constitutional reinterpretation that says Japan can engage in collective self-defense.
Right.
So that, I think, will be a good bellwether for how far Abe is going to be able to go in terms of the broader amending of the constitution. If he has a really hard time getting that security legislation that's already been proposed through the Diet, then he's probably going to back off and say the time's not right. If it's easier than expected, he might decide to push a little more. And that's something we're going to be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's actually going to be a major litmus test. You're absolutely right on the current state of the debate in Japan and the LDP's ability to push forward with reforms. Very shortly before we move on, though, Shannon, can you talk a bit about the response in China to this? Because, you know, as we all know, China's been concerned, probably you know, there's been a lot of public anxiety in China about Japanese remilitarization. I put that in quotes. So what has been the read in China of this Islamic State crisis and the effect it's had on Japanese society?
Mm-hmm. Well, China has, in official statements, repeated its view that it is completely opposed to terrorism in all forms, that the international community should join together to counter terrorism, kind of a boilerplate statement. But there is a lot of concern in China that Shinzo Abe is going to use this as a pretext to expand Japan's military involvement around the world. And there's actually a Xinhua op-ed that came out today arguing that. You know, it asks, and I'm quoting here, what tricks is Abe playing under the pretext of fighting against terrorism? So there is this concern in China that this is going to play right into Shinzo Abe's hand. Actually, if you go into the weeds of Chinese social media, there are some conspiracy theories that this was Abe's grand plan all along, that he needed to sacrifice these two Japanese hostages in order to get support at home for increasing Japan's security measures.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of suspicion here that this is, you know, this is just one more reason for Abe to increase Japan's militarization, and that that in turn is going to be a threat to China moving forward.
Hmm. Yeah, very interesting. That's I think we're going to see. I mean, obviously, you know, China's going to have a lot to say about the debate going on in Japan over this year, and particularly when it comes to the constitutional self-defense legislation. A collective self-defense legislation. We're going to see more of that as well. All right. Let's change gears a bit and discuss the recent Russia-China-India trilateral that took place in Beijing, involving the foreign ministers of all three countries. I think there's two things that just symbolically stand out. I mean, first of all, is the proximity to Obama's visit, obviously, which you know, was an important reminder when everybody was kind of euphoric after this visit, saying that India and the United States are finally coming together. It's finally happening. You know, Modi and Obama are going to be finally the two leaders that bring these countries together. And then after that, you know, India's the Indian foreign minister heads to China. They announced that Modi will visit China in May, pretty much on the first anniversary of him taking power in New Delhi, following up on Xi Jinping's visit in September. But also, I thought it was interesting that Xi Jinping essentially broke protocol and actually met himself. he himself met the foreign minister of India, which is pretty unusual from what I gather. So I think it definitely shows that India and China are moving forward. Most significantly, they again reiterated their honest intentions in resolving the border dispute. Shannon, could you tell us a bit more about this trilateral that took place in Beijing? What are your main takeaways from it?
Sure. So first of all, as you said, the timing is really interesting. It's kind of a counter argument to those people who think that in tilting toward the United States, India is necessarily distancing itself from China and also from Russia. And just one point on the meeting between Xi Jinping and Indian Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj. The reports I saw from Indian media did note this is very unusual, but it's actually not that unusual. Xi Jinping also met with the Russian Foreign Minister. He generally meets with the U.S. Secretary of State when John Kerry travels there, when Hillary Clinton travels there. So it's important also not to overstate what was happening here. But there were some important moves that came out, especially from India's perspective. Mm-hmm. India seemed quite pleased that China at least verbally announced a new commitment to supporting India's anti-terror proposals in the UN, which people in India read as a sign that China is going to be more willing to confront Pakistan on this issue. There's also verbal support now from both Russia and China in the joint statement that they issued after this meeting, supporting India's participation in APEC. Notably, it just said participation, not membership, but most of the Indian media is reading it as China and Russia supporting India's participation in APEC. So there are a lot of things that India is getting out of this meeting, and in return, it was willing to agree to some major points that are high on China and Russia's agenda. On the Syrian crisis, on the Ukraine crisis, those three countries joined together to kind of validate their position, which is very distinct from the U.S. position. And then you also had China, Russia, and India in this joint statement basically affirming China's vision of a new security architecture for the region, which they didn't go into detail in the statement, but it's generally read as an alternative to the current architecture, which is based around U.S. alliances, so as a net negative for the U.S. presence in the Asia-Pacific. And this is something that the Indian foreign minister signed on to. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here that you have to take with the context of the Obama-Modi meeting and put it all together to realize that India is not about to cut ties with any of these three major partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all very interesting. I mean, on one level, it makes India look a little bit confused when, you know, you have the Indian Prime Minister joining hands with Obama, making statements about the South China Sea and how he doesn't want to see Asia dominated by any single power, and then immediately heading to China and, again, concluding these agreements that show that, okay, India isn't entirely tilting over to the United States, like you said correctly. Mm-hmm. It's definitely very interesting. I believe they also discussed India's SCO bid, right? I think that was also part of the agenda.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's something that has been affirmed by both Russia and China previously. Mm-hmm. We do expect India to join, along with most likely Pakistan and probably Iran.
Yeah, and that's going to have some very interesting effects on India-China cooperation in Afghanistan as well, which is an SCO member. Mm-hmm. So it's that's definitely going to be a topic to watch as well. Prashant, do you have anything to add about the Russia-China-India talks?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely agree with Shannon. I mean, I found particularly interesting the mention of this the focus on this world order point that they raised, because 2015 is the 70th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations and the end of the Second World War, and so this idea of making India a part of SCO, and then also I think there was also a more concrete bid to support India's own admission as a member of the UN Security Council by both China and Russia. These things, there are a lot of constraints to them actually happening, particularly the UN point. And I think I always take these meetings between China, India, and Russia with a bucket of salt, because there's a lot of tension between each side of the of the relationship. So between China and India, you have, as Shannon noted, you know, the border issue is far from being resolved, although India has signaled that it wants an early settlement if possible. And then China and Russia, I mean, there's still a lot of tensions there that we won't see at summits like these, but, you know, that are actually playing out in other fora. So,
yeah, the border dispute thing is interesting because I think ever since Modi was elected and Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi traveled to India last summer, they've been saying that. But there's been very little concrete progress.
Yeah.
Especially after Xi's visit. Again, you know, Modi and Xi shook hands and said that we're going to work on this. They've been acknowledging, which is at least a good thing. You know, they haven't been entirely shoving it to the side when they're talking about international agreements and economic agreements. So that's a good sign. It's at least entering the normal agenda of diplomatic speak. But I think, you know, we want to see more in terms of how these two countries are specifically going to reduce, approach their dispute. All right, let's shift gears real quick and head to our final topic for this podcast, which is U.S.-Thailand relations and the Cobra Gold exercise. And Prashant, here I'm just going to hand it over to you. So can you just tell us a bit about the Cobra Gold exercise, what it is, and essentially, you know, just the recent happenings in U.S.-Thailand relations, notably, you know, Assistant Secretary of State Danny Russell's comments in Bangkok recently. And yeah, I'll just let you take over this part.
Sure, yeah. So the Cobra Gold exercises, you know, the largest multinational military exercises in the Asia-Pacific and one of the world's largest as well. They started off as bilateral drills between the U.S. and Thailand, but they have expanded to include somewhere between, you know, 30 countries, sometimes over, sometimes under. This year, the issue mainly is that last year you had the coup in Thailand in May, and so the United States had signaled in October last year that they're going to refocus and scale down the exercises scheduled for this year that are to be held in Thailand. But it's not been clear, as I pointed out in a recent piece, what exactly scale down and refocused actually means. Traditionally, Cobra Gold involves, you know, there's live fire exercises, but there are also humanitarian exercises and ways to build cooperation between the various countries that are involved. So the initial interpretation was that the live fire exercises, you know, would not be held and it would be more of a focus on non-combat and humanitarian exercises. But recent reports suggest that, you know, the live fire exercises may take place, but they'll take place with more of a non-military component. So the specifics are unclear. And part of this is because the Thai government, you know, under the ruling junta, has been very uncomfortable with, you know, even publicly admitting that the exercises have been scaled down, because that sort of gets at the legitimacy of their rule in the eyes of both the United States and the international community more generally. Mm-hmm. So the specifics on that are not clear. But, you know, what is clear is that, you know, the exercises are going to happen on February 9th. And that this is actually, you know, I would argue, I mean, exercises like these are the kinds of things that allow some of the big humanitarian and disaster relief missions that we see going on when, you know, a plane crashes or you have a typhoon or a tsunami. So it's important that this go on, but, you know, the United States has been also very adamant about signaling its discontent about the backsliding of democracy in Thailand. So,
yeah, it's interesting, particularly that U.S. Sources haven't really been too clear also about the extent of the Cobra Gold exercises. I think this is just an uncomfortable topic. Again, yeah. You know, it reminds me a bit of U.S.-Egypt relations after the Arab Spring and Morsi's rise as well.
Because the ambiguity.
Exactly. It complicated the extent to which the United States could militarily cooperate simply due to legislative problems there as well. Obviously, you know, a coup is, you know, a subversion of democracy, and to put it lightly. And yeah, I think we're going to see. Do you think this is going to actually have a long term effect on U.S.-Thailand relations? I mean, things have been fairly smooth since the coup. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, there's two sides to this. I mean, one is the optics, which is, you know, you mentioned Danny Russell's visit to Thailand, and the big headline there was he gave a public speech at Chulalongkorn University and basically, you know, said some things that the Thai junta didn't really like. And since then, you know, the relationship, you know, has taken a little bit of a downturn on the public side. Now, the people who have worked U.S.-Thailand relations for a long time, these are two of the, you know, Thailand's the U.S. oldest ally in Asia. The security and military cooperation that's been going on for decades is really important. And quietly, it's still going on. It's very critical for the United States and for Thailand. But the issue is really the tension between the optics and the actual cooperation that's going on. And also, you know, if you're of the belief that, you know, there's, you know, Southeast Asia is, you know, being contested by the U.S. and China, you would have been struck by the recent development, which was, you know, the Chinese defense minister paying a visit to Thailand and the Thai ruling junta making a very public attempt to say, oh, you know, the Chinese are coming in and they're more than happy to advance their military relationship with us. And they don't really care what happens with our internal makeup and the legitimacy of our rule. So, you know, if the United States, you know, wants to take up these issues with us, we have plenty of other partners that, that we can turn to as well. But it remains to be seen exactly what the substance of that cooperation is going forward. But, you know, nonetheless, the junta has been trying to make this point more generally.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very good point you made about the contrast between the optics and the actual substance. It actually kind of makes me wonder if the United States has simply gotten used to working with coups in Thailand. since, you know, there is a lot of precedence. And, you know, I'd imagine that at the State Department there is a in case of coup, break glass handbook for U.S. diplomats, essentially, to keep things moving. As you're, you know, you correctly said, it's the U.S.'s oldest ally in Asia. And particularly as the United States is looking to pivot to Asia, you'd think that they'd see Thailand as an important linchpin of their military cooperation with Southeast Asian countries in general.
Yep.
So, yeah. Shannon, do you have anything to add on that note?
I would just, you know, touching on the China angle, I would agree with Prashant that we shouldn't read too much into this, the relationship between China and Thailand. It's tempting to read Southeast Asia primarily as a battleground between the U.S. and China, but as with the example of India, as we just saw, each of these nations in Southeast Asia, Thailand included, also Vietnam, Myanmar, the Philippines, they all have their own agenda. And in general, that does not involve being completely dependent on or allied with either China or the United States. They have certain interests where they'll be best served by working with the U.S. and other interests where they are well served by working with China. So becoming closer to one side, we shouldn't automatically assume that means they're backing away from their other potential partners.
I think the point Prashant was making was that the Thai military was sort of holding that up as a bargaining chip for the United States. Essentially that the U.S. is anxious that that might be happening despite appearances. And essentially by saying that, you know, China's coming in, it's like, well, why aren't you? And, you know, I think it's kind of trying to play to that perception that exists in the U.S. government that any Chinese advances are necessarily detrimental to the United States when it comes to military cooperation.
I'd agree with what Shen said. I mean, I think the Thais, in particularly historically, have been known to play off different powers against each other, and that's one of the ways in which they managed to avoid being officially colonized for their history. So I definitely think that there's a lot of that's going on here, and so it's very important to pay attention to both the optics, but then also the substance of what is actually going on.
Definitely. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today, guys. This was a illuminating discussion, as usual, and I hope you'll come back to join me next week.
Yep.
Thanks, Ankit.
Thanks a lot.